Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, April 11th. Mahalo for joining us. Tit for tat tariffs, we look at the trade war in Asia, global markets swing up and down. Will lifted Yodas get a price hike? Health officials are monitoring for additional cases of the measles. A health communication researcher stops by to talk about vaccine misinformation. What happens when you follow the money? We hear about the latest guidance for teachers for when law enforcement comes knocking on classroom doors. A case on the island of Hawaii has communities concerned about immigration enforcement actions in schools. And we check in on what's shaping up to be the largest stained glass mural at the Kona Airport. It's a project that's been years in the making. You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been a week of dramatic price swings in global stock markets. Today, U.S. stocks are up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up more than 1.5% today. The S&P 500 up more than 1.8%. And the NASDAQ up more than 2%. Tariffs have been driving markets this week. But how are these developments likely to impact people here in Hawaii? And what can we look for clues as to what may happen next? Well, that's what HPR's Bill Dorman set out to find out. And he's here with a few takeaways from the tariff turmoil. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Catherine. Yeah, just starting with a reminder of what tariffs are. Basically, this is a tax on imported goods. Historically, they're usually passed on to consumers. The Trump administration, of course, has been through a few varieties of how they might be imposed. Some tariffs on all imports, others on goods coming from certain countries. Today, we're back to that three-month hold on most tariffs, except for China. China responded with its own increase of tariffs starting tomorrow. And while there are layers to this economic story, there are also some takeaways. And I wanted to start with one that has a direct connection with Hawaii. Trade deficits don't tell the entire story, because it's not all a simple case of where is something made. And a great example of that is Hawaii's favorite vehicle, the Toyota Tacoma truck. This has been the best-selling vehicle in Hawaii for 24 years in a row, as you know. One thing for sure, Toyota is a Japanese company, but the Tacoma is assembled in Mexico. The truck beds, steering columns, catalytic converters, those are made in Long Beach, California. The engines on the hybrid model, those are made in Huntsville, Alabama. So a tariff on the Tacoma has the potential not only to increase the consumer price for folks here in Hawaii looking to buy one, but if that leads to lower demand, it could hit some jobs in the United States. Takeaway number two, companies make investments, not governments. Less than 3 weeks ago, the executive chair of the Hyundai Motor Group was at the White House for an announcement about U.S. manufacturing. Hyundai is a South Korean company. It's been making vehicles in the United States since the mid-1980s. Here's President Trump at the White House.
Today, we're delighted to report that Hyundai is announcing a major $5.8 billion investment in American manufacturing. In particular, Hyundai will be building a brand new steel plant in Louisiana, which will produce more than 2.7 million metric tons of steel a year, creating more than 1,400 jobs for American steelworkers, and then there'll be major expansion after that. This will be Hyundai's first ever steel mill in the United States, one of the largest companies in the world, by the way, supplying steel for its auto parts and auto plants in Alabama and Georgia, which will soon produce more than 1 million American-made cars every single year. The cars are coming into this country at levels never seen before. Get ready. This investment is a clear demonstration that tariffs very strongly work, and I hope other things also, but the tariffs are bringing them in at levels that have not been witnessed. Hyundai will be producing steel in America and making its cars in America, and as a result, they'll not have to pay any tariffs. You know, there are no tariffs if you make your product in America, so
Yeah, I mean, that sounds good.
Yeah, but surprise, surprise, it's a little more complicated. This is not a result of the threat of tariffs. This has been years in the planning. And what the president describes goes to a phrase we all became familiar with in the pandemic, supply chains. Bring your supply chains closer to your markets, and that's going to reduce your costs and increase your reliability and predictability, which sets up takeaway number three. The economics of trade includes investment. It's part of the story with Hyundai here. It's been going on for a very long time. Japanese auto plants started coming to the United States in the early 1980s. Here's a fun fact, by the way. Japanese investment in the United States, nearly more than three quarters of a trillion dollars. The biggest foreign investor in the U.S. A lot of that is auto plants. Toyota, Honda, Nissan, jobs are U.S. jobs. In trade figures, those vehicles count as U.S. products. But the head of the Japan External Trade Organization told Bloomberg recently higher tariffs could actually lead to decreased investment by Japanese firms because the cost of doing business in the U.S. is going to go up because of the tariffs. So, again, that uncertainty. And that's takeaway number four. It's not about the economics of trade alone. It's about the politics of trade. And guess what? That includes a little flattery of President Trump along the way. Here's Yusin Chung, the executive chair of the Hyundai Motor Group at that White House event.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak here today. And thank you for the invitation. And congratulations on the remarkable start to your new term.
It's been good.
All right.
It's been great.
That complimentary tone continues when Chung talks about the broader plant and industrial complex that Hyundai has built in Georgia.
Our decision to invest in Savannah, Georgia, creating more than 8,500 American jobs, was initiated during my meeting with President Trump in Seoul in 2019.
That's right.
Yeah, and after that, 2020 in Davos, oh, I mentioned about the new plant. So American jobs was initiated during at the time. Now, as we proudly mark the completion of this transformative project in coincide in size with the beginning of President Trump's second term, making this moment even more special.
Thank you.
Yeah. Furthermore, HMG will purchase $3 billion worth of U.S. LNG to support America's energy industry and enhance our energy security.
More than a little irony there, those remarks, the chair of the Hyundai Motor Group, because the plant outside Savannah, Georgia was designed to build all electric vehicles. Ooh. But now it's switched to hybrids. And they're going to kick in buying some liquefied natural gas, which is not exactly clean energy. So politics of trade, somewhat flexible. But that's some of the things to watch for in terms of indications. Everybody's looking for an off-ramp, and we'll see.
Yeah, okay. If you're in the market for a new car, you're going to be certainly looking to see what's out there on the market and the price tag. But thank you, Bill.
You bet.
We've been hearing from HBR News Director Bill Dorman about the economics of trade, along with the politics, and what that could mean for consumers, including fans of the best-selling vehicle in Hawaii.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Some people hate to haggle. They'll avoid it at any cost. And then there are those whose enthusiasm for negotiating outstrips their common sense.
It's an easy strategy for winning any auction. Keep on bidding until no one else wants to bid anymore.
A better way to negotiate, this week, on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Maui Divers Jewelry, featuring tropical pearls, Hawaiian black coral, and gemstones in Made in Hawaii creations at locations across the islands and online at mauidivers.com.
The State Health Department has confirmed to HPR that there is a second presumptive case of the measles in a Hawaii resident. The individual is a household contact of the young, unvaccinated child who was confirmed earlier this week to have measles. The Department of Health says this adult traveled out of state and is unavailable for confirmation testing. Today, a distinguished health communications researcher is to speak at the University of Hawaii. Vish Vishwanath is a professor of health communications at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He stopped by our studios yesterday and spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the reemergence of measles across the country and in Hawaii.
We have always had incidents or cases of measles in the country over several years, but usually restricted to certain pockets, right, where vaccination rates have been lower. But because of high measles vaccination rates or MMR vaccination rates, in general, in the larger population, these eruptions have been restricted to those places, and that gave room for public health departments and authorities to take quick action and restrict those eruptions or infections to small areas. So what is different this time around is that MMR vaccination rates have been falling, primarily because of COVID. And what we are seeing now is a consequence of that. That is, when the vaccination rates fall below a certain rate, then herd immunity is eroded, as a result of which infections in one place are difficult to restrict to that place. And now you are seeing the consequences of that erosion in herd immunity.
So in December of 2024, you led a team that put together this National Academies report, Understanding and Addressing Misinformation About Science. And one of the things I thought was interesting was this tie between anti-vaccine content spread online and monetization. And that struck me as notable because you often hear within some pockets and circles, people say things like follow the money, or there's this talk of ulterior motives as it relates to funding. But when you follow the money, what do you actually find?
So this is very interesting, right? So from a consumer of health information perspective, it is difficult for me to see the pecuniary and monetary basis of some of these statements around vaccination or any science in general, right? Any public health practice. Because as a consumer, I don't have a lot of time in my life. You know, I just want good information that can take care of my friends, myself, my family. And I'm looking for that information. So I don't have time to do an investigation around that. On the other hand, as public health authorities and as reporters, as people who are interested in public health, if you start investigating, you find that some of these people who spread misinformation are also doing it to monetize from it. Though I should say monetization is only one of many different motivations for spreading misinformation. But if you take monetization, some of these people who are spreading, in the example of vaccines, some of them are also selling alternative products that they call medical products, right? I don't want to use the term medical products, but alternative products, which they're selling, they're hawking. No different from any snake oil salesman, quote unquote, that we used to talk about. And it is in their interest to sow the seeds of doubt and then offer their product. So it's important for us to call them out on it when needed and say how they are making money. But that's only, monetization is only one reason. There are many other reasons why misinformation can spread.
And I mean, I just wanted to follow through with that line of questioning because folks who will say they're raising questions about the efficacy of vaccines will point to officials and scientists that they say are receiving money from vaccine manufacturers. Do you mind sharing, you know, where your own funding comes from?
Happily. Almost all my funding comes from the National Institutes of Health. In the past, I have also received money from some foundations, such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You're raising an important point, and if you permit me, I want to clarify one thing about it. And this is important for the listeners to know. When you are a researcher like me in academy, I have to declare every year where my sources of funding come from. If I'm doing any consulting opportunities, what kind of consulting opportunities I have. If I have joint appointments or visiting appointments at different places, what appointments I have. These are called outside my regular employer. So according to the rules of the government, National Institutes of Health, and our own institutional rules, my life is an open book. I have to declare my non-employer interests publicly. And I do that. Now, can we say the same thing about these people who are spreading misinformation? Are they willing to come forward and declare their monetary interests? This is my challenge to them.
Any time a researcher publishes a paper, there's a big box at the bottom for funding declarations, any potential conflicts of interest.
And when we don't do that, there are consequences to that. You know, my work is acceptable to the extent that I have credibility. So when I don't declare, I am hurting my own credibility on this. Absolutely. You know, so we have to, in fact, I file disclosures. Every time I apply to the National Institutes of Health, I have to sign a declaration of disclosures. Mm-hmm. When I'm giving a talk, I declare my first slide is my disclosures. So I think we are very open about our funding. It's not that people are not getting money from pharmaceutical companies. They do. But pharma is not like big tobacco. I think as long as you're open, you know, where your money is coming from, let the listeners, the publics, make a decision on the credibility of it.
That brings me to my next question, especially given this case of measles. I think people in Hawaii right now are being exposed to a lot of different information coming from a lot of different sources on digital platforms, audio platforms, their social media accounts. How should we be good consumers of all this information, and how do we be skeptical when it benefits us?
Right. So that's good news and bad news here. The good news is the degree to which people are actually exposed to misinformation is much less than we typically assume. So that's one. And even after exposure, it just does not necessarily mean it will lead people to misbeliefs, and from misbeliefs to behaviors that are not conducive to health. So that's the good news. Now, what can we do about it? What we found in the report is people are not going out there to look for misinformation. People are going out there to look for information. And it just so happens if misinformation is more prominently available, then they're exposed to it. So as public health figures, as media personnel, reporters, and others, as academics, as researchers, the idea is, number one, increase the supply of correct information. We cannot eliminate misinformation, but we can increase the supply to correct information. Number two, we make sure that people have difficulty, quote, friction. There is a friction in accessing misinformation compared to accurate information. And third, we use, credible people. It could be the pastor in our church. It could be a neighbor. It could be a local community-based organization or a faith-based organization. It could be the governor of a state. People with credibility and authority should take more visible roles because they are the people who are paid attention to. Their word is heeded. So those three strategies can be very helpful in countering any misinformation.
So you'll be giving a couple of talks this Friday. Tell us a little bit more about what you have planned for that.
Right. So I have two talks. One talk is on misinformation. Your listeners got an advanced preview of that talk. It will be a little bit less conversational, more systematic. My second talk is with the Cancer Center, and that talk will focus on, it will connect two issues. One, there have been tremendous advances in medicine and science and technology. But how do we translate those scientific advances to influence practice, either medical authorities or people, is a big challenge. This is what we call as a translational challenge. To put it as a phrase, people have talked about translation of science and evidence from bench to bedside. I mostly focus on bench to trench, you know, to people, because I'm a communication scientist. So I'm going to talk about what are the challenges in the translational process. How do we improve it? Number one. Number two, I'm going to connect it to the fact that I want everybody to benefit from it, all groups. Generally, only some groups take advantage of these scientific and biomedical revolutions and the translation. The benefits from those translation accrue unequally. And my focus is on making sure that these benefits are accrued equally for all groups, irrespective of their backgrounds.
Is there anything else you want to add or anything you want to leave listeners with?
I want to say that we have come a long way in advancing the health of the population. Despite what we see, our lifespan and longevity has increased. For the large part, we are a much more healthier people, and we are enjoying the benefits of technology, whether it's internet, whether it's cell phone. And all that has been possible because we have invested in basic scientific research. And that investment over the last decades has made US a leader on many of these issues. So it's important, if we stop investing, if that investment is interrupted because we cannot see those advances with our naked eye, right, with visibility. It's not visible. It happens in the labs. It happens in the community. If we stop investing, those advances will come to a halt. And to rebuild that infrastructure and those skills, those personnel will be very, very difficult. And all of us will be losing as a result of that.
That was Harvard Health Communications Professor Vish Vishwanath talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. He is to give the keynote address at 5 p.m. today at an open house at the University of Hawaii at Manoa School of Communications and Information. We'll have links on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Later in the show, we'll be taking you inside the studio of a local stained glass and mosaic artist. Callie O'Neill's latest project is a mural at the Kona International Airport. But in 2014, she created Hawaii's first stained glass mural. The glass mosaic was crafted by O'Neill and her creative partner, Lamar Yoakum. It features the kukui tree, kalo plants, and the figures of two young hula students standing on the hands of their elders. More than 60 volunteers and 115 fourth grade students helped to construct the mosaic border out of 15,000 tiny pieces of glass. That's your hint for our backyard quiz. Today, we want to know what Central Oahu School features this 18 by 14 foot glass mosaic mural. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
This Sunday, Hawaii Public Radio brings you a performance entirely in Olelo Hawaii from our Live from the Atherton Mele Hawaii series. Enjoy music from Kilia. Join us for Live from the Atherton with Kilia Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR 1, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from West Hawaii Dance Theater's Wizard of Oz Ballet, April 26th at Kahilu Theater, featuring over 80 Big Island dance artists age 3 to adult. WHDT.org.
The threat of immigration enforcement action has worried teachers across the state after a boy in Kona was taken out of Kona 1 Elementary last month. His father had been detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Hawaii Department of Education released a document last month providing teachers with guidance on how to respond when law enforcement officials enter a campus. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with Andrea Eichelman, the Deputy Director and Chief Negotiator for the Hawaii State Teachers Association, about this new guidance.
So tell me, why was it important to make sure the guidance was distributed directly to teachers?
So many of our members are often assigned what's called teacher in charge. And so if you're at a small school, especially, and there are a small number of administrators, some schools only have just a principal, and that principal's off campus for the day, teachers can be assigned that teacher in charge status. And so they are the administrator for the day. So there's that dynamic. But in addition, our members were asking, hey, what happens afterwards, right? So I call my principal, what should I expect to happen? You know, they were saying, are the police going to come to my classroom? Is that going to be the process? And so they were just wanting to know. And they're concerned for their students. They want to know what was going to happen to their kid.
You brought up an interesting dynamic there, even in terms of what teachers might expect spatially in terms of law enforcement coming onto campus. Do we know anything about that in terms of law enforcement routinely going first to the principal's office, as it were, or do they approach classrooms?
Yeah, so the DOE has a standard policy that all visitors go to the office first. In addition, the teacher's contract, the HSCA contract, actually has very specific language about visitors to classrooms. And police officers in particular are listed and not supposed to be sent to classrooms unless it's an emergency. And we would consider emergency like a medical emergency kind of situation, right? They're responding as first responders in that regard. And so they are supposed to be limited to the office. And if a child does need to be removed from a classroom, then normally that removal is going to have some other employee, right? They might send a security guard to the classroom, but usually it's probably going to be just a phone call asking the teacher to refer the child up to the office, send them to the office, or perhaps a counselor might come by. It kind of depends on the situation and what's going on.
Well, your members have had the guidance now for, I think, a couple of weeks. What are you hearing from members in terms of the nature of the guidance?
Well, we were on spring break right after we requested the guidance. And then they've been back for about 2 weeks. And we really haven't heard a lot other than folks have told us they appreciate having something to refer to. Because prior to that, they were sort of in the dark. They just knew, you know, contact your principal. And so they do appreciate the assurances. We are aware as well that schools are being encouraged and hopefully are following through on reminding parents of the importance of having those emergency contacts up to date, because the department cannot release students to folks if they're not on that emergency contact document for families. And so, of course, that's something that not all families remember to turn in. Not all families have them on file.
Yeah, a good reminder there. And how about union leadership? Is there a particular position the leadership has taken in terms of quality of the guidance or what the guidance communicates to teachers?
I think for now we are satisfied. It's pretty extensive. It goes through the steps. It reinforces the obligations or lack thereof of the department to comply. It explains the differences between different types of warrants that might come forward and the protocols as to who needs to be called and how they need to be contacted. And there's phone numbers in case, you know, they can't reach a particular person. There's additional offices to call and prioritize that. We've been assured by the department as well that they have essentially a plan in place, a hotline, if you will. Once that CAS gets that call from the principal, they will put things in motion to immediately prioritize everyone, pull them out of meetings if necessary, and be on call to support that school as needed.
Has there been many situations already where schools or teachers have been made to confront law enforcement on campuses vis-a-vis immigration actions?
To our knowledge, no. Just the one incident that was reported in the media, and there weren't actual immigration agents showing up at that school. It was related to activities that happened off campus, but it did affect a child of someone who was detained.
And this was the elementary school in Kona, I believe, yes?
Correct.
And you mentioned emergency contact forms, which is a good reminder for families to check those and make sure they're up to date or make sure they're completed. What else would you highlight for students and their families to understand about the guidance, particularly in communities where there are mixed status families?
I think in those types of communities, many of our allies in the immigration advocacy space have been providing supports for folks, understanding their rights, understanding when and where they're obligated to respond to law enforcement officials, for example. And then I think the other point that is being made with many of these families, which is not a fun thing to think about, but having a family conversation about what will happen if a parent is, you know, targeted and picked up and then there's a deportation situation happening, what will happen with that child? Are they going to leave that child with maybe another family member or a trusted friend? Are there power of attorney types of documents that need to be put into place? And so we do know that our friends in that area of work are providing that advice to families to really have those hard conversations and think about what they might do in those situations.
And I'm looking at some of the documents in the guidance now, and there's plenty of text, of course, but there's also diagrams and outlines in terms of what happens if law enforcement shows up with a subpoena versus a warrant. And even that difference, I think, might be education for some teachers, right? I mean, I suppose this is sort of new information that they're meant to study, a little bit of homework for teachers.
Well, this memo, if you look at the top of the document, it is still addressed to complex area superintendents. It is addressed to administrators. But, you know, the department had provided it to us, and then they also had it linked behind the intranet, the interior side of the department's network, if you will. And so teachers can access it. There's not a requirement that they need to read it, but certainly many folks did want to understand those differences. And to your point, a lot of the general public do not understand the difference between an administrative warrant or a judicial warrant that is signed by a judge. And those are very different legal documents.
Yeah, they play a big part in terms of access that law enforcement should be granted in terms of those different types of documents. Very important points. Is there anything else that you would add for our listeners to know about the situation with the guidance? Yeah, anything that you think is important for parents or students or teachers to know?
Well, I think we do have this material available on our website. And so if folks are interested in reading the document, they can certainly look at that. We also have a broader guidance document that was created by our National Education Association that has a whole bunch of other information for those that are interested in immigration issues and how they're affecting schools. And so we're monitoring, you know, the situation closely. We're working closely with the Department of Education and our charter schools as needed. And hopefully we can continue to provide the safest and best education for our kids. We really don't know what's going to happen. Most folks that I have talked to believe that most of these activities will happen off campus. And so it's going to be sort of a secondary impact on students. We also are aware that many of these activities are under the guise of where students are involved of wellness checks. And you've probably seen some of those media reports. And so we're aware of that generally. And so we're hopeful that this isn't going to affect more kids, but it certainly could. We aren't at this point expecting that, for example, ICE officials are going to be coming to a campus and trying to pull kids out of classrooms. For example, you know, because student data is protected, that's not actually like there's no magical database they can look at and find, you know, John Doe's student is in room 2, for example. They're just not going to know that. The Department of Education doesn't necessarily keep records on immigration status. So even the DOE wouldn't be able to turn over that information. We don't think that they're going to be doing that. We think most activities will be off campus. And then the dynamic will be, hey, this parent is detained. What are we doing with this child, right? Are we turning them over to the police? Are we turning them over to an auntie or a mother, you know, the other parent or sibling or what have you, based on that emergency contact card? So that's really, really critical that folks have those filled out.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
That was HPR's D.W. Gibson and Andrea Eichelman, the deputy director and chief negotiator for the teachers union in our public schools. They were talking about guidance for teachers on how to respond to immigration raids and other law enforcement actions on campuses. We'll post that guidance from the DOE later on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
This week on It's Been a Minute, Make America Healthy Again. Crunchy moms and wellness influencers have a lot more in common than I thought.
The crossover is rooted in individualism.
And on Wildcard, actor Natasha Rothwell and I dig for a higher truth.
I don't want to believe in anything just because my parents did.
That's on Wildcard.
And It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Now it's time to shine a light on the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we introduced you to the work of glass artist Callie O'Neill. The Hawaii State Foundation on Culture and the Arts commissioned her to create a massive mosaic mural that was completed in 2014 called Kipapa and the Path of Light. It covers the exterior wall of a building at one of the oldest elementary schools in central Oahu. Under O'Neill's direction, students and volunteers from all walks of life helped to create the mosaic border, including the school's principal, head janitor, and teachers. For today's quiz, we asked you to name the Oahu school that features this glass mural. The name of the artwork gives away the answer because the school is Kipapa Elementary School in Mililani. But we stumped you on that one, and that's our quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. If you have flown in and out of the Ellison Onizuka Kona International Airport recently, you may have seen the beginning of what's to be a very large stained glass mural. It will consist of 8 panels, 2 that are expected to be installed later this year. The project has been years in the making, but it's taking shape with the help of key volunteers in Kupuna. We were invited into the studio of the mosaic artist Callie O'Neill on a recent trip to Waimea. We also met a couple of her volunteers who shared that this project is a true labor of love. We hear from O'Neill and longtime volunteer Julia Fairchild, but first we check in with team member Lamar Yoakum, who has the most experience working in this medium.
Ah, that happens. Oh well.
It broke.
Glass always breaks at its weakest point. So when you come to a real tight spot, it's iffy.
So you basically have to have the touch.
Yeah, that's about it. And of course, I've been at it since I was in my 20s and I'm 81, so I've got some touch.
Some touch. In the studio next door, artist Callie O'Neill is busy grinding away at the glass. She marvels at the breadfruit molds and says they have even melted sake bottles to create pieces to showcase.
So explain what you're doing.
So currently I'm grinding this
beautiful piece of glass that approximates an extinct Hawaiian bird. So it's been carefully hand-drawn and then enlarged 400%, put on Mylar pattern pieces, traced very carefully into the exact place where it would match the striations in the glass, would carefully match the bird, and then traced on glass, cut on glass, ground on glass, and then I'm doing the final fitting of the stained glass mosaic. And then the birds will be hand-painted, which isn't really painting. It's a technique from the 1400s where ground glass is mixed with gum arabic vinegar water solution. And then that gets fired at 1200 degrees. So there's just a little bit of shading to bring them more to life. People won't necessarily know they're painted because some of the glass is beautiful.
But it's really a layered effect then.
Yeah. And it's a more three-dimensional effect.
And what we're looking at here, it's almost like paint by numbers because you've got very specific areas where these pieces of beautiful glass go.
Yeah. And actually, there'll be tens of thousands of pieces of glass. The mural is 8 walls, 300 feet. So each of these pieces has probably, each of the tree arches has 1,500. And this is just one small element at the top of those 8 walls. So every wall has a native tree arch. And the kupuna have chosen their native trees, the kupuna that are guiding the mural, and they're in accordance to what elevation they're at and the meaning of the tree. And then each one has birds because that was Hawaii's, that was our top predator. That was our primary, you know, wildlife. And we've lost more than half of our native birds. So the native birds that are huge are alive. They call them extant in science. So the pueo, that's a 9-foot pueo. It's complete in mosaic. There is a nene here that's a 4-foot tall nene, my heartthrob. He's complete. And then the hydrological cycle I'll show you inside the design is there. And what we're working on, the kupuna are finished. This is Hannah Springer, who's a highly regarded kupuna here, and her son Kekaulike Tomek, who's a native dryland forester and also highly regarded.
So you've got that already complete?
Yes. Yeah. Most of the truck boxes are filled with the kupuna that are already complete that the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts has funded. What we're working on now is privately funded through my nonprofit organization called the Ramachi, are these tree arches. So these tree arches on wall one are complete. And these, this little small element in a 40-foot wall by 12 is all that on the table.
Okay, it's really colorful, but they're just huge sections. And so tell us, like, how many walls again at the airport?
There's 8 walls, and they're 40 feet by approximately 12 feet. So the mural is longer than a football field. It's 321 feet long. It's totally a Malama Aina mural.
And so where will people get to see it exactly at the airport?
It can't be missed. When you're in TSA, you can see the mural already. So spanning 321 feet in front of you when you come out of TSA, people have to pass by the walls, either going north or going south to the two different gates. It's right there. So it's in the departure area. And currently it's still protected with additional construction from plywood. Most of it you can't, but you'll see some of it on the way out. And you can see the background is mineral painted. So this is 100-year beautiful, earthy, subtle beak mineral paint. So I had special permission from the state to do this combination. Like this is a stained glass mandala. All of the wall one elements are complete. Perhaps I should take you through the walls.
Well, okay. So you've got 8 panels.
String out. They're not stacked like this. They string out, you know, horizontally for 321 feet.
And so you are in the beginning stages of installation because you're still creating some of the mural.
Yes, actually, we have not been admitted to the airport in 1.5 years because of additional construction, which is okay because we haven't stopped working for four. I haven't stopped working for 4 years. So it's a lot of research and design that came first with the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts, the kupuna, and my art advisory committee. And then this, all this, it's just, it's old world, labor intensive. you know, one careful, like, for example, what Julia is working on here, she's a master at tracing, which is a really important part of the process. She's tracing the stems for the kukui leaves, the chosen tree of, you know, Kumo Hana Springer. And so that's, each one is doubled. It's a mirror image. So she's tracing that with the mylar pattern, which, as you can see, the whole thing is very exacting. And then that will be cut on a ring saw, and then ground on that side. And it has to fit that pattern again perfectly before it comes over to me. And then we have one woman who volunteers. We have several key volunteers. One is here now. And her whole specialty is puzzling. She loves puzzles. So that is what she does. She puts the puzzle pieces on. That's her specialty. That's not mine. You know?
So your volunteers are here a couple of days a week, hard at work?
Yeah, they're hard at work. One is hard at work now. And so each person shows their ability, what they're really good at. Nagme is hired to be the protege of Lamar Yoakum, my like 40-year-long stained glass partner. He's 80 and she's perfect. So she's working really hard to learn what he knows because he's the stained glass master artisan in the state. He's the best of the best, but slowing down and knees, you know. So Nagme is doing the cutting, but she can also transition to whatever needs to be done. You know, Julia does primarily the tracing because nobody does it better. You know, and I focus on the birds or the focal point elements. There's Lamar on cue. Lamar Yoakum, Catherine.
Hi, Lamar.
Of HPR.
So you have a team with various skills, and you've all been working on this for a very long time.
Yes, it's a 10-year project. I'm in 4 years, probably over 4 years. And if we put it this way, people don't panic. It's a, I have 1 year per wall left to go. So there's seven more walls, you know, because all the elements are done for wall one. And so all of these walls are 40 by 12. So 1 more year, this is how I've learned to say that I have 7 years to go, because that puts people in a panic. And, you know, just it's very time consuming work, and it's beautiful. And the design is evolving, which I always knew it would. So the kupuna are set. They came about organically, spontaneously, by each other's recommendation and recommendations from the community. They're rock solid, standing for what they stand for in each of the eight aspects of Malama Aina. And then the other aspects are to be designed. So the kupuna help on that, but so do their protégés, you know.
So it's a work in progress.
Yeah, the elements are a work in progress. And they're what my committee would call the clarifying elements. Like, Callie, you got to have clarifying elements so that the message is clear whether somebody is running for a plane or they're one of the many now that have 2 hours and they want to absorb. And there's a lot of depth to it. I mean, I could talk for endless hours about the kauna of what the mural means, what it means to and from the wisdom, the traditional ecological knowledge of the Hawaiian people and its importance. Because in the Honolulu airport, things are divided, right? There's different areas. In Kona, it's everybody's coming out in one place. It's 3 to 4 million people viewing this mural from all around the world every single year. So it's said to be the most viewed work in the state of Hawaii, the biggest, the most viewed, and potentially the most impactful, which is my interest, because we want it to be educational. We want it to move people. I'm not the artist who has much of an interest in art for art's sake. I might love it on my own, but I that's not appropriate for public works. These public works have to speak to what's important. I actually had an interesting moment with my art advisory committee when they said, wow, if you have 8 different advisors, because I only work with one cultural advisor at a time for a project and all the projects that I've done for a very long time in Hawaii. And they said, you must be getting different stories. Each one wants this. And it's like, no, that's not it at all. They're all united. What's really important, they all want to stand for the forest, for restoration of the land, for care and restoration of the ocean and the community, you know, the culture and the community, everyone. We're all one, right? Doesn't matter.
It just must be so exciting, though, for your team members to play a part then in what will come together in a few years.
We'll ask Julia to speak to that. Julia, what do you want to say about
it's
that?
It's pretty exciting, all right.
And, you know, it the excitement, it's not like we're something we're looking forward to. It happens all the time. It really matters that the indigenous wisdom is like at the core, at the base of all of it. And we just do what they tell us to do. Callie knows how to do that, so we just follow what she tells us to do.
So the mural, it's about global environmental health. Without that, there is no human health. Without the health of nature, and the indigenous people worldwide have been telling us this for all time, and they live it. So the ones that we listen to now are the ones who have lived through so much devastation, so much desecration of their sacred land and forests, and they're still here, and they're still loving, and they're still kind, and they're still practicing all the values that are within Aloha. So I think the reason that this set of immensely important, esteemed kupuna trust me is they know that, like Shorty Bertelman, he's like, I know, I understand you're a worker bee. I'm a worker bee. I'm the hands of skill. And if I have so many, because drawing and design is my strong suit, right? Hand drawing and design. I can see what needs to be done. But it has to be in service to a greater whole. So the work is global in its orientation from the perspective of traditional ecological wisdom, which we must listen to because they're the only ones that know what we know is how to destroy forests and how not to pay people well who are working on conservation and, you know, restoration, the most important work there is, and the future for the children, that they get a healthy planet to live on, healthy islands for sure, because it's a fragile place.
And the message is, these are some things of value.
Yeah, I mean, the message is so simple. That the kupuna teach me all the time is, take care of the land and it will take care of you. And the land isn't just the living, you know, fully microbial, alive soil. The land is every aspect of what lives. It's the birds, it's the trees, it's the grasses, it's the fish ponds.
And all that will come to life as the panels are installed. We plan to periodically check in on this work in progress. O'Neill works hard to get it right, and she shares that in the middle of this project, turns out she's losing her lease on her home studio and will have to relocate. She is selling some of her previous work to finance the move. We'll have links on our website to find out more. That is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, more on the tariff talk. What questions do you have? Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere you tune in for podcasts. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.